You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WBIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Heartland Politics podcast, which is aired and distributed on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad City region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're going to take a break from all the talk about politics and analyzing the 2020 election to look at a totally different topic. I'm really pleased to welcome back America's leading author of Hollywood stars and film history. He's been on my show previously to talk about his biographies, one of John Wayne, who, of course, was born in Iowa, and another fascinating story of the friendship between Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda. And I'm still have him on my list to read some of his previous works. But today, we're going to be talking about his latest book called Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise. He's Scott Eyman, and many of you may know him from his books or from his frequent appearances on Turner Classic Movies, where he discusses movies and his thoughts. And he's always somebody interesting and to talk to, and he's also written for the Wall Street Journal quite a bit. Scott, thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Always happy to talk to you, Robin.
Well, I really enjoyed this one, too. I feel like you're on a roll. I learned a lot about Cary Grant. I had some knowledge of him, but I was interested mainly because of your previous excellent work. But the subtitle, A Brilliant Disguise, it was an interesting discussion of how his upbringing really kind of cast a shadow over most of his life.
Quite true. Quite true. Yeah, the point of this, I guess, of the narrative and of the title is the fact that, you know, he was born Archibald Leach, in Bristol, England, and Cary Grant was a part that he devised incrementally once he got to Hollywood in late 1931. You know, he didn't really burst into flower until 1937-38, when Cary Grant appears full-fledged. But until then, his entire life had been a process of self-invention. And once he found Cary Grant, once he became Cary Grant, once Archie was transformed, he still had the core problem of feeling like Archie and playing Cary, and how to bridge that gap. And that's essentially the story of the book.
He had a pretty rough upbringing, working class Bristol, England, but also. The relationship with his parents, especially his mother, is just tragic, and obviously plays a leading role in his narrative in his life.
Probably the leading role in his narrative. His father was an alcoholic pants presser of very little use. His mother was emotionally compromised. She had lost a child at the age of one before Archie was born, so she hovered over Archie relentlessly. At the same time, she gave him a lot of attention, but not much love, because she really wasn't capable of giving love or of receiving love. When he was 11 years old, he came home from school one day to find his mother gone. His father told him that she'd gone to the seaside, which is odd because Bristol's only a couple miles away from the sea. But anyway, he is a kid, so he accepted it. And over a week or two, she didn't come back. And then there was an evolution. And then one day his father told him, well, she died. And so the kid didn't really know what to do or say, because he and his father were not close. But he had to accept it because he really had no choice. He didn't find out until he was 31 years old that his father had had his mother committed to a mental institution about 3 miles from the house where they lived. She was actually in Bristol the entire time of his adolescence and growing up. In a mental institution. He was already in the movies at that point, and you can imagine the how it rocked him back on his heels to find out that the mother he thought was dead was in fact alive. He got her out of the institution, set her up in a house in Bristol. She lived on her own for more than 20 years, and then when she got a little old and frail, she moved to an assisted living facility. And he would visit her every year, but the relationship was never came to any fruition, because she still had all the emotional problems that she'd had as a younger woman. They were probably amplified by over 20 years in a mental institution. So, as I said, she couldn't give or receive love. He would send her gifts and buy her things, huge hampers from Harrods and color TVs when color TVs were just coming out. He sent her all these things, and she usually would not even open the packages. You know, he would go there once a year and find all the stuff that he'd sent her. Still, you know, stacked up, unopened. So it was just an absolutely unrewarding, unnurturing a relationship, and it was basically the black cloud over his entire life.
How did this young man growing up in working class England wind up in the United States?
Well, he kept a diary when he was 14 years old for about five or six months. And it's a fascinating document because it clearly shows what a lone wolf he was even at that age. He's not going to school very much at all. He's cutting classes constantly. And he was a good student. His grades, the report cards that survive are in the high 80s and low 90s. So he was always very smart and intelligent, but his intake of information was very disordered. And by the time he's a teenager, he decided, this isn't for me and Bristol's not for me. He's on his own. He's going to the theater. He's going to vaudeville. He's going to the movies instead of going to class. And his father doesn't really show up at all in the diary. Nobody does. What took the place of family, conventional family, was the theater. He started going backstage to the Hippodrome, which was the big vaudeville house. It's still there in Bristol, as a matter of fact. Was the big vaudeville house in Bristol. And going backstage, and he saw the camaraderie between the performers, and there was a kind of warmth and a family atmosphere, which he had no knowledge of. He was fascinated by it, and he began gravitating towards the theater. He got a job there working part-time. And that basically, he set his cap for a career in show business as a means of getting the attention and the warmth and the camaraderie that he didn't have in his life.
How did he develop, again, the working class background, the sense of, I mean, when you think of Cary Grant, you think of style, debonair. How did he develop that?
Well, he apprenticed himself. He got kicked out of middle school, which he intended to do. He had no, you know, he knew what he was going to do. He got kicked out of middle school, and he got his father to sign him over in his apprenticeship to an acrobatic troupe, a very well-known acrobatic troupe in England called the Bob Pender Troupe, second generation group. And he stayed with them for the next 4 years. And he learned this craft. He learned how to be a complete acrobat. And if you think about it, the foundation of his art is his control of his body. The gap between what he is in a comedy, like His Girl Friday or Bringing a Baby or Arsenic No Lace. I mean, he's unhinged. He's like a rag doll almost in his use of his body. And in a drama, he's absolutely controlled and almost rigid. His entire body stiffens up. And that all derives from his command of his body that he learned as a teenager. And he came over to America with the Bob Pender troupe to work in American vaudeville. And he stayed with them. That was in 1920. He stayed with them for the next 2 years, getting his feet wet in American vaudeville. And then one day he told Pender he wanted to go back to London, wanted to go back to England, rather, to see his father. So Pender gave him the money for his passage. And Archie had no intention of going back to England. He didn't care about his father particularly. He used the money Pender gave him to get an apartment in New York on his own. And he simply blew off the acrobatic troupe and hunkered down and started getting jobs in American vaudeville. So that was essentially, he used the Pender troupe as the vehicle to get to America.
He was really, I found it fascinating, his initial impressions of America. And you can just picture this traveling across the country, and he's looking out at night over these small towns, the lights. What was kind of his impressions of our country?
Well, ice cream. I mean, you know, you had 15 flavors of ice cream. You didn't have 15 flavors of ice cream in England. You had three or four. The richness of it, the bounty of it, the skyscrapers in New York City, which was his first, you know, his basic home base from 1922 from 1920 when he arrived with the Bender troupe to the end of 1931. So he spent 11 years in New York City, headquartered in New York City, working in vaudeville or going out on shows, you know, making the route and occasion. And then he worked up the Schubert organization as a young leading man. So it was just the bounty, the size. He discovered baseball. He became a huge baseball fan. He stayed a baseball fan all his life. And he followed the Dodgers. And when they moved to New York, moved to Los Angeles in, 1958, 59, it was a homecoming for him because he had been a Dodgers fan when he was a kid in New York City. So he actually fell in love with the country in a way that many immigrants do, you know, because it was a 180 degree, turnaround from the environment he'd known in England, in Bristol.
Like many of us in our careers, we get kind of a break. We struggle, we work hard, and then somebody comes along and gives us a break. And I thought this was an interesting part of your biography as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the Pender thing gave him the foundation, the skill set that he used for the rest of his life as an actor, really.
Yeah.
And he said, in terms of the Cary Grant persona, he said, what you do is, and I think this is essentially true, because I've seen the same thing with writers, is what you do until you develop a personality of your own, an artistic personality of your own, what you do is you essentially imitate people that you think are very good or skilled or cool. And as it's filtered, as that imitation is filtered through your own personality with a little age and a little seasoning, you develop an authentic personality of your own. He said that it all basically begins with imitation. And what he said he was imitating was that whole school of English actors that we think of when we think of Noel Coward or the young Laurence Olivier. You know, very sophisticated, tuxes, hand in pocket, always urbane and smooth and never ruffled. And he said that was essentially the beginning of the Cary Grant persona. He didn't know how to do it. And the reason he kept his hand in his pockets was that he was sweating so much he couldn't pull them out. Because they would stick, you know. He said, but that was the beginning. And he said he thinks most creative people do that. And I think he's probably got a point.
You're listening to Heartland Politics Podcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And today we're taking a step away from politics to talk about a new biography of Cary Grant, written by Scott Eyman. We've been just talking about Cary's background here, Cary Grant's background, and there's an interesting involvement, local involvement, that we'll get to a little bit later in the conversation. But I guess I wasn't aware of some of his earliest work, but what film was really his breakthrough moment where he became a bigger star and more noticed?
He hit that sweet spot that actors occasionally get where they've served their apprenticeship, and then there's three or four pictures in a row, and everybody's wondering, where's he been all our lives, or where's she been all our lives? As I said, he starts in 1937 with Topper, then comes The Awful Truth with Leo McCary, then comes Gunga Din in 1939, and His Girl Friday, and Only Angels Have Wings, and he reeled off like seven or eight smash pictures in a row with no, like boom, boom, boom. It was like a batter suddenly getting hot, you know, and he could see that everything he hits is a line drive or a home run. It was an extraordinary run of pictures, and he became the leading man for that era before World War II and through World War II. And what's unusual about Grant is he sustained. He had very few down periods. There was a down period in the early 1950s, and Hitchcock yanked him out of it with To Catch a Thief. But basically, he maintained his momentum by defining his screen persona and more or less staying within it for most of the time. He turned down a lot of pictures that would have been startling alternatives to what people expected from a Cary Grant movie. He turned down the Judy Garland Star Is Born. He turned down The Third Man, the Orson Welles part of Harry Lime. He didn't really turn down The Man Who Would Be King. It was John Huston who later made the picture, with, of course, with Sean Connery and Michael Caine, a wonderful movie. And he wanted, his initial plan was to make it with Humphrey Bogart and Clark Gable in the late 1950s. Bogart died, at which point he offered the part to Cary Grant, who had done something similar 20 years earlier in Gunga Din, but then Clark Gable died. So he had to wait 20 years to get the picture made, but Grant turned down a lot of pictures that raise a lot of eyebrows today. He turned down Billy Wilder 5 times. He turned down Sabrina. He turned down Love in the Afternoon. He turned down 1, 2, 3. I mean, and drove Wilder nuts, because Wilder loved him. He thought he was a superb leading man, and Sabrina and Love in the Afternoon are perfect vehicles for Cary Grant. And he wouldn't do it because he didn't care. Wilder made him nervous because Wilder had sharp elbows and he was sarcastic. And Grant didn't like directors like that. He didn't like directors who yelled. He didn't like directors who were sarcastic. He liked a very calm, serene director like Alfred Hitchcock or Leo McCary or Howard Hawks, guys who never raised their voice. He didn't like any director that created an atmosphere of tension on the set, because Cary Grant carried more than enough tension for the entire production.
Well, one of the interesting parts, too, I found was the relationship with Hitchcock. They got along pretty well, it seemed like, for the most part. There were a few bumps in the road, but it led him to some of his significant work. I don't know why, but I think my favorite Hitchcock movie is North by Northwest. It's always been, and I
that's the general favorite. That's the one most people think of when they think of Cary Grant and Hitchcock. I like Notorious a lot. I think it's one of Grant's finest dramatic performances, and I like the film because it's a slow burn. It's a very tense, and the kid's character is just filled with rage, sexual rage, actually. And I like To Catch a Thief as a star vehicle. I think North by Northwest is wonderful. I think it goes on maybe a little too long, but that's just me. Maybe I am perfectly willing to accept it's the general favorite. But no, he adored Hitchcock, and they had a lot in common because they were both lower middle class kids that nobody expected anything from. Because look at Alfred Hitchcock; he's shaped like a potato. You know, he happened to be a genius, but in England that doesn't get you much leverage because he was the son of a grocer, and Grant was the son of an alcoholic pants presser. So what are you going to do? You're stuck. But they both came to America and they both had immense success and they understood each other on a kind of cellular level. Each of them understood the other's strong points and each of them also understood the other's weaknesses. Grant realized that he had a lot of leverage with Hitchcock because in Hitchcock's eyes, Cary Grant was the ultimate leading man. Nobody else could be. Everybody else was an instead of for Cary Grant. Grant was always Hitchcock's first choice. And Grant understood that and used that to his advantage. And Grant and Hitchcock, on his part, understood that Grant was a performance and that the real man was Archie Leach, and that Archie Leach was very difficult and very anxious and very nervous and had a very fraught emotional life, which not a lot of people were aware of, because Grant could flip on Grant at all times easily. And people speak when he became Cary Grant. People said, oh, he's just like Cary Grant. Well, actually, he wasn't, as his wives found out.
Yeah, all five of them.
All five of them.
He was a serious student of his craft, too, which I found interesting. He would go and watch his own movies in theaters and watch how the audience reacted.
Well, success was important to him. Money was important to him, as it is to many people who are born poor. So most people in the show business watch their movies in screening rooms, you know, with 5 or 10 people, most of whom are friends and sycophants, and everybody thinks everybody's wonderful. He would always watch his movies in a crowded theater. He wanted to see what the crowd reaction was. He wanted to see what they laughed at, what they didn't laugh at, what moved them. He wanted to see what worked as a performer. In the same way, I think that when he was an acrobat, he probably watched other acrobats to see how they did the tricks. He knew how they did the tricks. He knew the techniques, but he wanted to see the showmanship, the flamboyance. He wanted to see what sold the tricks. You understand? And so he was, in the same way, he was watching his own performances to see what sold and what didn't sell.
I just saw that the movie Charade probably two weeks ago and really enjoyed it all over again after reading your book. He was really critical of the changing nature of comedy, where it became more insulting. And I think it takes more talent to do the type of comedy he did than what they use now.
Oh, sure. It wasn't punchline humor. Most modern comedy is set up punchlines, jokes. And character comedy, which is what he did, is situation comedy, is much harder to sustain. And he understood that. If you look at a movie like Bringing Up Baby, which is basically one situation repeated for 105 minutes, where he's trying to get away from the Katharine Hepburn character and she's constantly pursuing him, that's the central joke. It's just simply a reversal of the usual dramatic thing where the man chases the woman. No, the man is terrified of the woman and wants nothing to do with her, and she will not take no for an answer. Well, now that's funny to begin with. Okay, but he brings so much to it physically, because he's playing a guy who's obsessed with dinosaurs, and he's trying to put together a dinosaur skeleton. He's an archaeologist, and that's all he thinks he cares about. He doesn't care about girls. But he does so much with the character physically. When he has to run, he runs as if his knees are bandaged together. His whole body, the top half of his body is immobile. He doesn't move his arms or shoulders. He just runs with the bottom of his legs. It's very funny to see, but it's thought out in terms of a comprehensive physical approach to the character. And I think that's a derivative of his upbringing as an acrobat, as a technician, as a physical technician. But he by the 60s, I mean, Charade is what, 63, I think, 63 or 64. The times were changing. The kind of comedy that he liked to do was not being done very well anymore. And the men that he liked to work with were dead or in decline. Hitchcock was declining. Leo McCary was inactive and would die soon. Howard Hawks had turned to John Wayne as a sure thing, because his last couple non-John Wayne pictures hadn't done well, so he just decided to work with John Wayne, make westerns. So the people that Grant really liked to work with, of his own generation, were disappearing, and there weren't a lot of directors that he felt comfortable with. One was Stanley Donen, a younger man who he did four pictures with, Indiscreet, which is wonderful, and Charade, which is excellent, and a terrible picture called The Grass is Greener, and another terrible picture called Kiss Them for Me. But he liked Donen because Donen was polished and had style and made him feel comfortable. He worked with Blake Edwards on a picture called Operation Petticoat, and Blake Edwards is a superb comedy director. He made the Inspector Clouseau movies with Peter Sellers, and they didn't like each other at all. And Blake Edwards was really thought he might get fired. Grant might fire him off the picture, because Edwards hadn't made any big movies at this point, and he realized he had to pull himself in. But he really didn't like working with Grant, and Grant didn't particularly like working with him. And because it was, I think, just a basic generational difference of outlook on what constituted good comedy. But it was harder for him to find scripts he wanted to do. It was harder for him to find directors he wanted to work with. He was quite wealthy by this time. And so what he always really wanted was a child. He adored children. He was great with children. Anytime a child worked with him in Hollywood, they came away with with 50 or 60 years worth of anecdotes about how wonderful Cary Grant was to work with to a child. And a lot of actors don't like to work with children for obvious reasons. They can't sustain a performance indefinitely. They're cute, so they can draw attention away. He adored working with children because he loved children. When he finally had a daughter in 1966, he just said, "I'm done. I'm quitting. I'm going to raise my child." And he never really looked back. He got offers constantly, and he just turned them all down. And it was at that point, when he quit show business, that he started lessening the distance between Archie Leach and Cary Grant. And by the end of his life, he was far more like Cary Grant than he ever had been when he was an actor and a comedian working in Hollywood, because he could relax and he didn't have to worry about, I guess, the whole imposter syndrome, which I think was a major problem for him, because he knew he wasn't Cary Grant. He knew he had all these wives, and they were kind of rancorous divorces because he was difficult in a domestic relationship. And that's not something you think of with Cary Grant, the screen character. But if you knew Archie Leach, you'd say, yeah.
We have to bring up his use of LSD, which he was very open about, which is another shocker that I found something new I had no idea of. But he found this as
well. It was legal at the time. It hadn't been outlawed at that point. It was not a controlled substance. It had to be done under doctor's supervision. But this is in 1958, 59 when he started taking it, because he was desperately looking for, when you're poor and you're starting out and you think the conventional attitude is, if I can get money, if I can get leverage, all my problems will go away and I can relax. And of course, it doesn't really work that way, because you're still the person you were and you still have all those insecurities and all those fears, and money doesn't necessarily take all of them away. And he tried psychotherapy. He didn't like it. It didn't work for him. And he tried everything else, and there was nothing left. It was a Hail Mary. LSD was constituted a Hail Mary. And it worked for him. It worked for him very well. At first he took it under supervision, doctor's supervision. Then, he felt secure enough with it that he would just do it at home, you know, and, if it started to go wrong, he would, put some music on or something, and that would help him get out of it. But he was very secure within his trips. And he proselytized for it. If people would come to him and ask him, should I try this? Should I do this? He would absolutely give them positive feedback, you know? He became the go-to guy in Beverly Hills for trying LSD, especially amongst his generation. I don't think Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper went to Cary Grant. They didn't need to go to Cary Grant. But but that generation in their 50s and 60s needed a little reassurance that this would not, like, scramble their brains. And it's true. He thought it made a big difference in his life. The people that worked with him didn't really see much difference. He could still be nervous and anxious and touchy, all the things he had been before. But inside, he felt it had made a huge difference in healing over some of the wounds, and it made him able to deal with what he called my own hypocrisy and the world's hypocrisies. And it calmed a lot of his demons.
And of course, if as locals are aware, he passed away in Davenport, Iowa, one of the Quad Cities.
He did. He was doing his conversation with Cary Grant, the thing he did the last, I don't know, 3 years or so of his life.
Yeah.
Where he would go to towns and you know, people would come in, and it basically was just a Q&A. People would just ask him any question, and he would answer that very honestly. And it was 90 minutes. I saw him do it in Fort Lauderdale. He just happened to be in Davenport, and a couple hours before he was due to do his 8 o'clock performance, he developed headache and nausea, and he thought it was food poisoning from lunch. It turned out to be a massive stroke, and he died that night. He never did that final conversation with Cary Grant.
Stayed at the Blackhawk Hotel. About 30 seconds left, Scott. For listeners out there that are younger, maybe, and are interested in Cary Grant, what are say three or four movies that you think would be his best performances for folks to watch?
Oh, for comedy, His Girl Friday, Bringing Up Baby, Arsenic and All Lace, his least favorite. He hated that film. He thought his performance was way over the top. I think it's an amazing piece of farce. Farcical performance for comedy. For drama, None But the Lonely Heart, Notorious, Hitchcock, To Catch a Thief, and with a bow to you, Robin, North by Northwest.
Thank you very much. And with that, I want to thank you again. Scott Eyman's been our guest today. And folks, if you need to do some last-minute Christmas shopping, this is the perfect gift. He's the author of Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise. Thanks again, Scott, for being our guest today.
Anytime, Robin. Thank you.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.